It was about 8 years ago, about 9 years ago, in the fall of 1998. And there we sat, maybe a dozen of us in a room. Myself, my good friend Carol Reback, and several others who had come together over our shared desire to battle for a new accessibility law to remove the barriers that impede people with disabilities in this province from fully participating in all aspects of the life this province has to offer. 3 years before, a newly minted premier, Mike Harris, had been elected on a commitment to keep all his promises. One of those promises was to pass the law we were seeking, the Ontarians with Disabilities Act. But 3.5 years later, still no law, no date for a law to be introduced, nothing. We were pretty frustrated, and we were trying to figure out what to do about it. Well, we had decided to try to get an opposition member of the legislature, now the Finance Minister for Ontario, Dwight Duncan, from Windsor, to get him to introduce a resolution. And the resolution would call on the government to pass a Disabilities Act that fulfilled 11 principles, the 11 things we were looking for. And we were trying to figure out, now that we'd come up with this clever idea, how on earth we were going to actually get it passed. Because we thought if it did get passed, it would stand as an emblem of what the government had to do. And if it didn't get passed, it would stand as proof that the government really wasn't prepared to keep its promise, even though it was elected on a platform that it, unlike all other governments, would keep all its promises. We had to figure out how to sell this. Well, the day was coming up very soon when the legislature was to consider and vote on this resolution. It was going to be October 29th of 1998. And we were mulling over ideas when all of a sudden my friend Carol Reback, a veteran of advocacy, a person who had lived with the use of a wheelchair for some years and keenly aware of the barriers we face, she got an idea. She said, October 29th, that's just 2 days before Halloween. Why don't we make our slogan, "Hey government, will the Disabilities Act be a trick or treat?" And from there we got the idea that why don't we go to the legislature the day the legislature is to consider this resolution, why don't we do what you do on Halloween? Go door to door. Well, that's what we did. We declared that day to be our trick-or-treat day. No, we didn't come in costumes. And we arranged to go to the legislature with a view to going knocking on the door of every member of the legislature we could get to ask if they were going to vote for our resolution or against it. Would they make the Disabilities Act a trick or a treat? Well, we had a little bit of a problem because we had all the people ready to come. Everybody organized. We were going to divide into teams to work our way through the building. Carol would lead one of the groups. Some of my other colleagues would lead others of the groups. And off they would go tricking or treating. But I got a call about 5 o'clock the night before from the office of the Speaker of the Legislature. "You're not allowed to do that," we were told. "You can only come to the legislature to meet with a member of the legislature if you've actually got an appointment." I said, "We can't have an appointment. We're going to knock on their doors. That's the whole idea." They said, I was told, no, you can't do that. And you can't walk around the legislature like that. It might cause some disruption. I said, "What disruption?" I said, "We promised to be polite. We promised to be nice." They said, "This is a demonstration." I said, "No, it's not a demonstration. We're just going to talk to members of the legislature. Isn't that what the building's for?" Well, after a certain amount of negotiations, we were successful in winning the right to do our trick-or-treat thing. And our members went from door to door throughout the legislature, knocking on doors. The MPPs had no idea what to do. One was seen running down the hall going, "Whatever it is, I'll vote for it." Another member was seen turning to somebody in his office saying, "What is the Disability Act anyway?" But they just mouthed the words, unaware of the fact that just outside that door were a bunch of people who are hard of hearing, who read lips. Somebody complained they were worried that our group would be too noisy. Well, our lead group was a bunch of folks who were deaf. They used sign language. They weren't making any noise at all. They went door to door. The members of the legislature eventually filed into the legislature, and our resolution passed unanimously. An hour later, at a news conference, then opposition leader and future two-term premier Dalton McGuinty entered into the media studio at Queen's Park to announce to one and all that if elected, he would pass a law that fulfills this resolution. A commitment that later formed the basis of his election platform in 2003 and all the negotiations that later led to the enactment in 2005 of the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. When we started out on this campaign back in 1994, we were not a well-oiled, well-funded, well-organized, well-populated group with a concerted strategy in mind. Much to the contrary, we were about 20 people who didn't even know we were about to start on this movement, who happened to end up at a meeting room at the legislature, and who ended up forging the foundation of a coalition that would serve this province for the next decade until that legislation was successfully passed. I had the privilege of serving first as its co-chair and then as its chair. In fact, we started out without money, without a plan, without an organization, and frankly, without much of an idea of what it is we were doing. I would like to take the time over the next few minutes with you to give you a few of the lessons that we learned, I, my dear friend Carol, and others, about how to do it, and to use where I can the work of my friend Carol Reback to illustrate these techniques and tactics. The bottom line of my message to you is this: the biggest enemy, the biggest adversary to effective community organizing and social justice advocacy is not politicians who aren't interested or bureaucrats who create impediments or the media who don't want to pick up on the story. They're not the biggest obstacle to success. The biggest obstacle to success is the belief by people like us, like you in the room with me, like anyone listening to my words, that success in social justice advocacy is just not possible. The belief that you need to have gobs of money, that you need to have a big organization, that you need to have fancy lawyers, that you need to have expensive lobbyists, that you need to have a detailed plan, and that you need to have mainstream society already on board. That is the biggest obstacle. Once you get rid of that obstacle, anything is possible. Once you get rid of the belief that you yourself can't actually make a huge difference by some pretty simple strategies, then the rest follows. You can be successful, and frankly, you can have one heck of a lot of fun. Let me tell you before I launch into my practical tips a bit about me and a bit about Carol. I graduated from Osgoode Hall back in 1979 with absolutely no idea that I would get involved in anything remotely like social justice advocacy as a hobby. I stumbled about a year or two later into a group that was working on advocating to get disability into Ontario's Human Rights Code, and worked with others to successfully get the Canadian Charter of Rights amended before it was passed in 1982 to include disability in the equality rights provision of our new constitution. About 12 or 13 years later, I happened to again stumble into this new movement for a new Disability Act, ended up, through a weird chain of events, becoming its co-chair and then its chair, and then spent the next decade or so learning on the job. And most recently, I've learned about the joys of bringing test case litigation by myself, bringing a complaint, a human rights complaint against the Toronto Transit Commission, first to force them to announce all subway stops, and then to force them to announce all bus stops, so blind people, and by the way, sighted people, can know where the heck they are and when they should get off the TTC. It was all learning by doing. My friend Carol Rebeck, who sadly never made it past her 52nd year, started out her life as a person without a disability, but in her adult years developed paraplegia and ended up using a wheelchair. She had all sorts of complicated health issues, which ultimately took her life far too soon. But during the years that she had, she became a powerful advocate both within the Disability Act movement and elsewhere for equal opportunity for people with disabilities, with a particular emphasis on access to public transit here in Toronto, but not an exclusive emphasis. She was trained as a therapist, not as a lawyer, but she was a bright, charming, charismatic, and articulate speaker who could deliver a message as effectively, if not more effectively, than anybody else I've had the privilege of knowing. What lessons can we learn? Any of you watch Monty Python's Flying Circus reruns? One of my favorite scenes, I may get it wrong because it dates back to my partially sighted days of over 30 years ago, is a cartoon of old ancient philosophers on a soccer field. And they're walking around, and in the middle of the field, there's a soccer ball. And none of them know what to do. So they walk around looking very ponderously, gazing at it, when one of them, presumably Archimedes, goes, "Eureka!" runs up and kicks the ball. And all of a sudden, the soccer game breaks out. That, to me, is the world of political advocacy. We have communities out there who need progress, who need social justice, and they're just waiting for one of you to kick the soccer ball, to get the game started. How do you do it? Here's a series of practical tips. First, you need to set an ultimate goal. It can be a big goal. It can be a long-term goal, but it should be a universally appealing goal. It should be a goal that unites, not one that divides. When we started out in 1994 with the Disability Act movement, we decided our goal was to make Ontario a barrier-free society for all people with disabilities, and to do it through new legislation. And we decided on the goal barrier-free society because it had several advantages. First, who could argue against it? Who's going to say, no, I like a society full of barriers. I like a world that people can't fully participate in. That sounds great. Bring them on. More barriers, please. Who's going to deny that we face barriers? Who's going to say, oh, no, people with disabilities, they can get into any building, blind people, they can read any government publication. Not a problem. No one's going to say that. Who's going to say barriers are good for society? Nobody. Moreover, it was a message that would unify disparate disability groups. to a blind person, barrier might be the lack of Braille on an elevator, elevator buttons. To a person in a wheelchair, like Carol, it may be steps to get into a city bus that she can't get into. To a person who's deaf, it may be the lack of sign language. Barrier-free society was a message that would speak to all of us and would unite all of us. So it's a message that unites your community and on which no one in society can plausibly oppose. That's where you want to start. And it's a dream, it's a long-term dream, but it's a legitimate dream. My next tip is that you should then start setting a series of short-term, intermediate goals to work towards. These are goals that should be practical, doable, achievable in the short term. My analogy. You get in the car with your family in Toronto to drive to Florida. It is a long, boring drive. It will be but moments after you pull out of the driveway when the kids turn to mom and dad and say those magic words, "Are we there yet?" Now, there's two answers that mom and dad could have. One is, no, it's a long, boring 24-hour drive between here and there. And the other is, guess what? Our first stop is Niagara Falls. It's only an hour and a half away. It's one of the wonders of the world. It's one of the coolest places. What should we do when we get there? All of a sudden, that leg of the journey feels a lot shorter, and getting there is something worth doing and is worth celebrating. That's what we did with the Disability Act movement. So that, for example, when we decided to go for a legislative resolution, it wasn't binding on the government legally, but it would be powerful politically. But it was something we could start out in working on in August and have finished by the end of October. And that's what we did. It could be the focus of all of our efforts over that period, both at Queen's Park, lobbying door-to-door, or going to the media, or doing letters to the editor, or encouraging people around the province to write or visit their members of the legislature. It was something we could get people involved in that was helpful, but was Niagara Falls, not Florida, as a destination. And once we got there, we could celebrate our victory and then get on to the next objective. And by the way, that resolution has become and remains to this day the yardstick by which the Disability Act is measured. When we today complain that the government isn't effectively enough implementing the Disability Act, we say that their implementation of it does not fulfill the promise of that resolution from 9 years ago. So while it was a short-term target, it had huge long-term potential. Third, the third step in your in your activity, once you have your long-term goal in mind and your short-term objective established, the third step is when we start organizing and we try to do what I believe is what I call building the least critical mass necessary. I don't believe you need hundreds and hundreds of people to start an organization and put it on the map. We had a joke in the Disability Act coalition that I was involved in. One person alone is a game of solitaire, two is a conversation, and three is a Disability Act committee meeting. As far as I'm concerned, as long as you've got enough people to fill a table, even a small one, give yourselves a name, you've got an organization. In explaining how effective you can be, even if your numbers are small, I want to describe an incident that took place early in our history, which was before I met Carol Rebeck, but had I met her, man, it would have been just the best kind of activity for her to be involved in. She sure would have thought of it if she'd been on our team at that point, but I hadn't yet met her. It was the spring of 95. We'd only formed a few weeks before. We only had a handful of members. The Ontario election was on, and we couldn't get any coverage. Elections are not a good time to get coverage of political issues, I regret, perverse as that sounds. So we decided on the advice of one of my colleagues, to try to create an event to get attention. Somebody said, why don't we find an all-candidates debate that's inaccessible to people with disabilities? Now, it seemed at that time absurd that anybody would even have an inaccessible all-candidates debate. Of course, we found one, and 12 years later, they're still happening. But in any event, we found one by phoning around, looking up where all the all-candidates debates were going to be, phone up, find out if they're accessible. Well, that's not going to work for us. Find one that's inaccessible, and then we got a bunch of people there. It wasn't very many people. It was 12. Some with disabilities, some without. But we got word to the media. They came with their cameras. And there was this picture of people with disabilities on the steps of a schoolhouse where there was going to be an all-candidates debate to debate education policy, but we couldn't get in to talk about why more schools aren't disability accessible. Get the picture? That alone would have been enough for a good kickoff event, but it got better. People were going in, people were going upstairs, people without disabilities, and the all-candidates debate started. Somebody from my group, I don't know who, and it wasn't on my suggestion, took it on themselves to go upstairs, go to the all-candidates debate, and make a shame on you speech. How dare you people have an inaccessible all-candidates debate? Do you know that there are people out front with disabilities? They can't even get in here. You should go down and talk to them. I didn't even know this was going on, by the way, but what happens? But a few minutes later, the front doors of the school open, and out come the candidates who start talking to us. The TV cameras, again, start rolling. Then, after a few minutes of them talking to us, they said, we've got to go back upstairs. One of my colleagues said, you can't leave us out here. And the candidates turned around, getting ready to go inside, but then the doors to the school opened again, because the people upstairs, the audience, got bored waiting, so they came outside with us, and they brought their chairs with them. In the end, they all came outside, they all brought their chairs, and the entire all-candidates debate was held on the sidewalk in front of the school with, may I add it again, the TV cameras rolling. That night, a dozen of us secured radio, television, and print news coverage during an election campaign, which, as I said, is one of the hardest times to get a political issue on the public agenda, perverse as that sounds. And we did it with a tiny little group and no name recognition. That is the least critical mass you need. Start small. People will join you when they see you're making progress. Next tip. Don't worry about formal organization and titles. The usual format for building any kind of social justice organization is to set up titles, set up an executive, you've got to have a secretary, you've got to have a treasurer, even if you have no money. You've got to have committees and subcommittees and bylaws. The Ontarians with Disabilities Act committee that I chaired for all those many years never had any of that. We just worked on an informal basis. Everybody was a member. My friend Carol Reback gave more television interviews and public speeches than virtually anybody else in the coalition. And that's a pretty tough standard to meet because there were lots of really good people who gave lots of interviews and lots of presentations and public speeches. And she would be introduced as Carol Reback, member of the Ontarians with Disabilities Act Committee. She never had a title and never really cared that she didn't have a title. The great thing about not having titles is you don't have to have any elections, you don't have to have any conflict, you don't have to have any fights, you don't have to have any political tension, because everybody's got the same title. One of the only people with a title was me. I was a chair, a piece of furniture. Big deal. When we'd organize in different communities, I'd ask one or two people to take on the role of sort of the point of contact, and they sexiest title we could come up with them was Regional Contact. I said, it sounds like something on top of a battery. We did not ever have a single fight in any of our 23 regions, to my recollection, of people demanding to be a regional contact but not being given that title. And by the way, if anybody asked for it who didn't have it already, I'd say, you know what, we already have three regional contacts. You want to be one? You're our fourth. Fine. The least bureaucratic organization, I believe, the most effective. And Carol Rebeck stands, and her legacy is to show how much of a difference you can make by being an effective presenter, whether or not you have a formal title. My next organizing tip is don't worry about money. One of the standard expectations of people who do any kind of organizing is we've got to get a grant, we've got to find some money, we need donors. I am proud to say that in its 10 or 11 years, the Ontarians with Disabilities Act Committee never had a budget, never had a bank account, and the one time anybody tried sending us a check, we wrote them a note thanking them and sent it back. Now, this may seem just a little counterintuitive, but most of what I'm going to be telling you this afternoon is counterintuitive. How do you do it without money? Well, you do it without money by getting other people to do the work. For example, though, if you've got no money, it's much easier to ask people to volunteer their time and effort. We had all sorts of people prepared to give us their time and their effort because we didn't have a staff and we couldn't afford one. And nobody could turn to us and say, I'm not going to do X for you because you've got staff and they'll do it. When we needed work done that involved financial issues, like mailings or whatever, we relied on community disability organizations, the big ones that you know about in our community, that provide services either to people who are blind or people who are deaf or people who have different kinds of disabilities. And we asked them, we said, we've got individuals who are donating their time. Will you folks donate some of your staff time? And they would. And they did. And they did a really effective job. We were also able to tell those organizations that we're not going to compete with them in the fundraising environment. By the way, there's another really good reason not to worry about raising money. If you've got no money, you've got no money to lose. Nobody can dictate to you that if you take their money, you've got to have their message. And nobody could threaten to revoke your funding. Finally, with the internet, money becomes far less important than it ever was before. Previously, if you wanted to get information out to a broad public, you had to be able to print up copies and mail it to people. Now, with email and websites, you can reach thousands and thousands of people just by having access to one internet and email account. My next suggestion to you is, in terms of action, is once you've got your goal long and short term, once you've got a small critical mass, once you've decided not to weight yourself down with bureaucratic organizational structures and budgets and money, the next step is to come up with ways to make as many people as possible your social justice foot soldiers. And the way we learned to do this was to try to become the fast food of political community organizing and advocacy. What makes fast food so successful? I regret it's not. It's nutritional value. What makes fast food so successful is the fact that it's so fast and easy. You can walk into a fast food place, pick what you want, get it, and be out the door very quickly. We learned over time that you will get more political action happening from more and more people if you can deliver to them the tools for political action the way fast food chains can deliver food. How do you do that? Well, early on, I learned this lesson, and it's no brilliant insight, but it was pretty telling. I would give talks to community groups, and I'd say, you know what? the government isn't delivering a disability act. They promised it. Everybody would go, yeah, that's outrageous. And I'd say, we need your help. And people would all go, yeah, we'd love to help. And I'd say, I need you all to go home and phone your write your member of the legislature and demand that they pass the disability act. And everybody would dutifully and sincerely say, I'm going home and I'm going to write a letter. And guess what? Most people didn't. It's not that they didn't because they didn't care. And it's not that they didn't because they were disingenuous when they said they would. It's just that we're all very busy. We've got a lot of things going on in our lives. And it just became another thing on the pile of things to do. And frankly, it seemed a bit daunting for people who've never done it before. So what we found was a shortcut. As we started using email, we would draft a sample letter to members of the legislature. And we'd send out an email saying, hey, why don't you write your member of the legislature? We encourage you to do it in your own words. But to make it easier, here's a sample text you might want to start with. And we'd also give them the members of the legislature's email addresses. And within seconds of sending out that email, people were cutting and pasting it into messages to their members of the legislature and copying it to us. Instant political action, just add water. Well, from this we learned that if you compile together a series of fast, easy-to-do, simple strategies into a short, simple document, you'll get people doing more and more stuff. So we devised what became known in the Disability Act activities as an action kit, so that before we would go after a legislative resolution or some other key objective, we would release an action kit and say, look, for the next 3 months, our goal is to get this resolution passed or whatever. And here are things you could do. Why don't you write a letter to the editor? Here's a list of addresses. Why don't you write your member of the legislature? Here's a list of email addresses. Use your own words, but here's a sample you might want to consider. And all of a sudden, people started doing one or more of our various ideas. But what also happened is people would look at our ideas and go, those ideas are boring. I want to do something different. One example of those is my dear friend, Carol Reback. Partway through our activities, she and other colleagues, friends of hers, decided that what would be really helpful is to put together a video that explains what barriers people with disabilities face and what kind of, or what a disability act could do for them. And this was not on our action kit because it's way more work than writing a letter of letter to a member of the legislature or whatever. And she got together with particularly one of her colleagues and friends who was she brought into the movement, and they arranged to do some filming and some editing, and they eventually put together a really good video, which was then made available for community groups to view to help spread our message to places where we couldn't send a speaker. So once you start out with an action kit, you find out that other people come up with their own ideas. Another friend, also who sadly passed away, named Michael Lewis, came up to me at an event. He's a blind and he's a folk singer. He said, how about if I write a song? I said, sounds great. And he wrote a song called Still Waiting. And it was the message that we're still waiting for this legislation. It was a very powerful song. And in fact, a community group in London where he lived put together a video to go with the song depicting the barriers that we were waiting to remove. These are all fun to do, important and effective strategies. Now, if you think back to any organization you've ever gone to or meeting you've ever been at, what happens at those meetings? People get together and they sit around, they talk about what you should be doing. You should be doing more, usually whoever's chairing the organization, everybody says what you should do. We turned it around. Instead of having those meetings, we used the internet or mail or any other medium we could to get this information out, not to say what I should be doing, but what we all should be doing. And by doing this, you got not only people acting on our action kits, but the Carol Rebacks or Michael Lewis's or others getting together and making their own, devising their own ways to get their message across. And this became really, really effective. Now, the next action tip I want to talk to you about is learn to be creative in the use of the media. I've talked about the media for a couple of minutes, but I want to talk some more. The media is a tough nut to crack. It's very easy for all of us to complain that they don't cover our stories and they cover too much that's frivolous and so on. And I've done my fair share of complaining, too. And if you've ever seen any news clippings in which I'm quoted, you can rest assured that for anyone in which we managed to get coverage, there are dozens of times we tried to get coverage and weren't successful. There's a few tips about working with the media that I've learned and I'd like to share. The first is, you've got to understand that the media do not cover issues. The media cover events. So that if you were to pick up the phone today and call the media and say, I have a news story. There are all sorts of places in Toronto that are inaccessible to people with disabilities. The person would be listening and wondering, like, that's very interesting, but that's not news. Or if you say, you know, I went to the government and I asked them to address this problem and they didn't address it, well, join the lineup of everybody else who's gone to the government and asked them to address important problems. They haven't addressed it. Those are issues. You need to create an event. Now, when it comes to creating an event, the instinctive first reaction of a number of people who do or think about social justice advocacy is the protest. Let's get a bunch of people together and let's have a demonstration. I don't do demonstrations. I don't have anything against them. I don't say don't ever do them, but I don't do them, and I've virtually never taken part in them. Why is that? Well, for one thing, I happen to think they're boring. I mean, what happens in a demonstration? A bunch of people get together, hi, how are you, what's new? If you've read, did you see the latest whatever movie? Okay, shh, we have to get angry now. And then somebody gets up with a megaphone and tells us why we're angry, and we dutifully are angry. And then what do? We have a chant, and it's always, hey, hey, ho, ho, blank has got to go. We don't even have original songs. This is not news. This is boring. Not only that, but it doesn't actually convey a message. You want, when you go to the media, to convey a message not only by your words, but by the picture. Now, I happen to be blind, and I'm telling you about framing pictures. Go figure. But if somebody's lying in bed with their spouse at 10 at night, and they're flipping through channels, and there's the news, and they're half paying attention, and it's just a bunch of people angrily waving signs. For one thing, it doesn't convey a message, and for another thing, it doesn't particularly grab anybody, doesn't invoke automatic support. If the words on the signs are things that the person already agrees with, yes, they agree with you, but so what? They already agreed with you. So instead, what you want to do is to create an event that is a positive, constructive message that makes your point. Let me go back to the illustration of two illustrations I've given you. The day that we were in front of that schoolhouse, not able to get in, to take part in an all-candidates debate about education, the picture was the message. The picture of people with disabilities in front of a flight of stairs and politicians coming out looking sheepish was the message. Moreover, if you went home and told people, can you believe they have all candidates debates that people with disabilities can't get into? The reaction is, that's ridiculous. I can't believe that's happening. That's ridiculous reaction is what makes it news. And by the way, you can do that with a small number of people. As I said, we did it with 12 or so. The other example, by the way, is the day that, on Carol's suggestion, we did the trick-or-treat initiative at Queen's Park. When you walked around the legislature that day, there were about 180, 200 people with disabilities at the legislature that day, playing, you know, knocking on doors to talk to members of the legislature. Now, the usual motif would have been a protest out front. Go to Queen's Park. Look at the field there. What does it hold? About 20,000, 30,000? If we had 200 people out front with signs saying, hey, hey, ho, ho, whatever has got to go, it would look like a really badly attended picnic. But if you go into the building and have the exact same people not waving signs and not chanting because you're not allowed to have a protest inside the building, and I committed to the folks who did security at Queen's Park, we were not going to do a protest, and we wouldn't chant, and we wouldn't have any signs. What does it look like? 200 people, a lot of them in wheelchairs? Gridlock! Wall-to-wall people. It was very effective as conveying a message. Not just what we were saying, but the very fact of our being there. Now, I will tell you, by the way, that another tip about the media is don't sweat when you don't get coverage. You should assume that more often than not, you won't, no matter how much you try. I can tell you that we got great coverage when we did the event out in front of the schoolhouse. I can tell you that the day that we got that resolution passed in the legislature on October 29th, 1998, the single most pivotal day, probably, for most of the decade of our fight for the Disability Act, the turning point, the event when we got not only a unanimous legislative declaration in our favor, but the future premier of the province at a press conference with us undertaking to comply with it, we got not a single word of news coverage. None. Zero. And one of the lessons I've learned is not to sweat that. Yeah, you go home and frustrated, you wish you had. But the realities are, if something happens somewhere else in the world or some other big news event happens, you get smoked. It just happens. So when you plan these events, you plan them to try to make them successful whether or not you get media coverage. And if you get media coverage, so much the better. Now, I could go on forever, but I'm going to just cover a few more important points. Let me talk to you just briefly about dealing with the government, or frankly, any organization you want to influence, because there's a series of things that we learned that we learned. About how to do this, that take some time to garner, but once you get a hang of them, they actually work really quite well. First, when you're dealing with government or any other important decision maker, the first and most important and sometimes the hardest thing to do is to find out who really makes the decision you want made. Now, that may seem pretty obvious, like if it's a new legislation, isn't it the government or isn't it the premier or whoever? But it's usually way more subtle than that. And it's, if anything, one thing I have learned is that if you contact government and tell them you want to discuss an important issue, 99 times out of 100, they will refer you to someone to speak to. And the someone they will send you to speak to is the person who has no power whatsoever to give you anything of what you're looking for. Now, if I was entirely conspiratorial, I'd say they do that on purpose. If I was entirely cynical, I'd say it's because they don't know what's going on half the time, and so it's just random. I don't know whether I'm conspiratorial or cynical. I just know that that's what happened. So what I will spend a fair chunk of time doing is finding out who the real decision maker is and to try to get to them. Next, it's really important early in the process, whatever issue it is you are going after, to put your request, where possible, in writing. And to write it in a letter that is self-explanatory, that explains what you're asking for, whether it's a disability act or whatever it is, but that will speak not only to that decision maker, but that will on its own, in one or two pages, speak to anyone, anyone who later reads it. That letter will become the platform that you will use, whether it's meeting with other members of the government, or opposition members, or journalists, or members of your own community. It should explain your message cleanly and clearly to all of them. And, back to my opening salvo earlier on, it should make your request sound not only as completely reasonable, but as something that one cannot plausibly say no to. In other words, put the request in terms where even if the recipient doesn't want to give you what you want, they may feel they just can't say no. In my experience doing social justice advocacy, sometimes people in government do the right things for the right reasons, and sometimes they do it for the wrong reasons. I don't care why they do it, I just want them to do it. And to that end, if you go, for example, to the website of the Ontarians with Disabilities Act Committee, which is now wound up, but our website's still there, www.odacommittee.net, or to our successor, we've passed around a sign-up list, and our chair, Catherine Dunphy, who is fabulous and very effective, is here. The Alliance, or pardon me, the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act Alliance, AODA, alliance.org. If you read any of the letters we write government, whether we're writing government that's being friendly to us or that's been hostile to us, we always write our requests in terms where the recipient is going to look at it and go, oh God, I can't say no. And the importance of that kickoff letter it has many reasons why it's important. It's important, obviously, to try to get action out of government. It's also important to put others on notice what you've requested, whether it's the opposition or the media. It's an education tool for explaining your own community what you're up to and to establish unity within your own community. And finally, it's important because that initial letter, whether it's asking for a disability act or whatever action you're asking for, starts the clock ticking. From then on, the timer is running. If you don't get an answer within a month, you can write back and say we haven't heard from you, or you can phone up. If you don't get an answer after a couple of months, you can go to the media and say this is the unanswered letter for which we have no response. If you need action, you might go to an opposition member and have somebody get up at Queen's Park or in the federal parliament in question period, wave the letter around and say, 2 months ago you were asked this very simple and obvious question, and why haven't you answered it? And what's even better, by the way, is before you plant a question like that in question period, is to call up the office of the recipient of the letter and say, just to let you know, we're anticipating putting a question in question period, though obviously if we can answer, we don't have to go through all of that. And sometimes that gets action. The next strategy I want to suggest to you with government, any government, is that you do, wherever you can, you've got to view the world through the eyes of government, not through the eyes of your own community. This is really tough to do. It is very counterintuitive for community organizers. We are so busy being pickled in the needs of our own community that we rarely place ourselves in the headspace of the people to whom we are advocating. But it is absolutely critical to place ourselves in their headspace. Let me give you an illustration. We used to say that there are, whatever, 15% of people have disabilities. And we thought that was a pretty powerful message. It didn't go over so big. One day it occurred to us that instead we should change our verbiage two different ways by putting ourselves in the headspace of elected politicians. What do elected politicians think about? They don't think about people. They think about voters. And they don't think about percentages. They think about raw numbers. So we suddenly said, instead of there are 15% of Ontarians with disabilities, we said there are over 1.5 million Ontarian voters with disabilities. All of a sudden, they started listening. And within days of using that language, literally you could track this at Queen's Park, politicians on both sides of the aisle started talking about 1.5 million and started talking about voters with disabilities, seeing the world through their eyes. The next strategy I'd like to suggest to you in terms of dealing with government, not just finding out who the decision maker is, not just putting your position in writing, not just thinking and seeing the world through their eyes, do their work for them. Now, at one level, you might say, oh, come on, why should we have to do that? You know, that's what they're paid for. You've got to do their work for them. If you want them to change legislation, you've got to try to come up with as much detail as possible of what you want in the legislation. Now, non-lawyers might find that intimidating, might figure you got to be a lawyer. Lawyers might find that intimidating, saying, hey, I'm a litigator, I don't do legislative drafting. Well, I will tell you, I've never done legislative drafting, but man, you can learn very quickly as a lawyer if you have to. But I'll go further. You don't have to be a lawyer to be able to make a profound, substantive impact on the wording and details of legislation. And I can think of no better illustration of that than my friend Carol Reback. She was trained not in law at all, but when we had the Conservatives' Weak Disability Act back in 2001 before the legislature, and I'd cranked out some, 100-page brief. People ask me why we lawyers call a document brief when it's 100 pages. I sent it over to Carol, and she read it through and got on the phone and tore the thing to shreds and made a whole bunch of suggestions for constructive changes. Now, we lawyers instinctively think that we know all, and lay people think they know about it but don't really. And why don't they just leave it to us? Well, my friend Carol was sweet, was charming, and also spoke her mind. And if I had ever said, don't worry your head over this stuff, her response to me would have been rather blunt and indelicate, and properly so. No, I had to answer her questions, and to answer them in terms that lay folks can understand, absorb, critique, and respond to. And if I could make my case, fine. And if I couldn't, she'd say, that sounds great, David, but here's why you're wrong. And we'd hassle it out. And between us and the other input we got from other lay people and lawyers, we got a better product, a much better product. Now, I will tell you that there is a huge tension or predisposition on the part of lawyers, including lawyers who work with the poor and the disadvantaged, to think that let's leave it to lawyers. Let them worry about this technical stuff. I learned through my work with Carol and with the broader disability community that lay people have a ton to say and a ton to offer in terms of constructive, substantive input on the most complex legal issues. And we cannot allow our own sense of either self-importance or specialized knowledge to trump their wisdom and their right to input. By our work together, we were able to put forward a series of constructive amendments. In 2001, the Harris government, in passing their Weak Disability Act, disregarded many, if not most, but even those which were rejected, formed the basis for the negotiation for the stronger Disability Act that the McGuinty Liberals were to pass a few short years later. My final message on all of this, before I conclude, is strategies for dealing with internal division. There is always concern that within any social justice movement, there will be internal division and fear that disunity will be destructive of the cause. On this, as well as so many of the other issues I've been discussing this afternoon, I must say that I am quite unorthodox in my thinking. Disunity doesn't worry me at all. It's something you've got to think about and for which there are strategies. But I do not have unity or unanimity as a goal ever. Why? Because in any large community, it is impossible to get everybody to agree on virtually anything. People have independent minds. People have their own views. People have their own agendas. Unanimity is impossible. And if it's impossible to achieve, it is foolish to make its pursuit something which will hold you back. What the pursuit of unanimity does is it empowers a small group of individuals or even a single individual who want to thwart your efforts. Any of you see the movie The Life of Brian? Back to ancient history, but one of my more interesting sources for political inspiration. There's a scene where Brian, played by Graham Chapman, is standing in front of a crowd preaching to them. And they're echoing back everything he says. And Brian yells at them, "You are all individuals." And they all chant back together, "We are all individuals." And one guy goes, "I'm not." I love this scene every time I see it. But the pursuit of unanimity gets the guy who says, "I'm not," all the airplay. That's the one that the media turns to and says, despite the movement in favor of X, so-and-so says, "I'm not." Or the headline becomes, "Dissension in the community. Disability community divided over blah, blah, blah." So if it's futile to pursue it and only would serve to actually make it harder to get your goals, what do? We decided to pursue harmony, not unanimity. And the way we did this was to follow the following steps. Before we would come forward with an agenda on a particular issue, we'd consult our community and ask for input. Then once we got their input, we try to come up with a platform, whether it's a brief or our 11 principles or whatever, that was as effective as possible to cover the common ground of as much of what we heard. We couldn't please everybody, but cover it as much as we could, while still being realistic. We would then say to our community and to government, "Here's our platform. We hope you will recommend it to government too. But we urge you to also add your own thoughts. Add your own points. Let them know where you disagree with us and where you agree with us. Mind you, if you do have things to add, we'd like to hear from you, because if you've got a point we haven't thought of, we too would benefit from hearing about it." We did not ever claim to be the sole legitimate spokespeople for Ontario's disability community. We just said, "Here's our own particular viewpoint." Whether we were a group of 20 when we started, or 23 regional groups by the time we finished around the province, we only purported to speak for those within our own group. And we encouraged everybody outside our group as well as inside it to also take their message to the government too. And in fact, when the government would introduce a bill, or introduce an initiative, even if it was exactly what we wanted or largely what we wanted, and even if the government met with us, meaning our coalition, on close consultative basis, we would still insist that the government hold an open consultation with the broader community. And we did that because we wanted as many people to get heard as possible. We didn't ever say, you know what, the government's listened to us, so why should anybody else get heard? We got our message through. Even when we knew to a certainty that we were getting our message through, we found it effective to give other people a platform. Now, when people came forward to government, did they all agree with us? There were areas of disagreement. And frankly, I thought that was great. I made a presentation to the standing committee that dealt with the Conservatives' Weak Disability Bill on the points that I thought we should emphasize back in late fall of 2001. My friend Carol Reback went and made a presentation on her own. Now, she had been with me at a number of the major meetings we had negotiating key issues with the government and with the opposition. And one way of looking at this would have been to say, oh my God, if they see Carol there, they'll think that we've had a fight and that we don't agree. Nobody ever thought that. She went in, she made her pitch, she focused on the issues that mattered to her, and she was fabulous, as were so many other presenters, as were so many other presenters. And by taking part in that process, by advocating for the opportunity for everyone to take part in our process, people felt a sense of inclusion, and it was legitimate. And rather than people complaining to us, you know, that we're trying to hog the field or whatever, we were able to achieve a level of harmony, not unanimity, but harmony, which is a realistic goal. And there were a few people, a very small number, maybe just one or two, who just thought from the disability community the idea of a disability act was a bad idea. And you know what? They came forward. They made their point heard. But there were none of those headlines, disability community divided. Because we never claimed that unanimity was our goal, our reality, or even something that was possible. Finally, we found that a way to avoid dissension and a way to keep harmony within the community was to come up with a way to convey our message that swept each of us into each other's issues. So that, for example, before there was a cross-disability movement, you would find people like me talking about the need for more Braille on public buildings, elevators. And you'd find my friend Carol Reback, who uses a wheelchair, talking about the need for level access to buses rather than stairs. This kept us each in our own silos. And it also let the government see us as groups that they could divide. If you give one what they want, they'll buy them off, get rid of them, and then the other one will have less chance to be heard, and you can say, well, we already dealt with one group, we got nothing left for you. When we worked together, what was seen was different. You saw Carol Reback, who's quite sighted, talking about the need for Braille. And you saw David Lepofsky, who can walk and climb stairs, talking about the need for level access on buses for people who use wheelchairs. And this was an extraordinarily powerful message because it showed that we were united and that we were on each other's issues, not just our own, and had found a common ground to fight for them together. But what it also did was it created a force for unity internally instead of a risk of division or infighting. Just have a moment. Let me conclude with just a few very short points about success. And they all come from not only my own personal experience, but those of my friend Carol Reback, whose memory we've dedicated this lecture. First, it's really important to have fun. It is really important whether things are going well, which sometimes happens, or things are going poorly, which quite often happens, to just have a good time, to laugh. I like the image of us at Queen's Park going door to door, smiling, much more than I like the image of standing in front of Queen's Park, yelling, angrily waving placards. I like having fun. So do most people. Frankly, as far as I know, so does virtually everybody. And my friend Carol knew how to do it as well as anybody. Next, celebrate your victories. Part of the strategy of saying next stop Niagara Falls, not next stop Florida, which is a huge long way away, is not only to make it easier to see your destination, but when you get there, to have a good time. Go out, celebrate, have a party. Even if what you're celebrating is that we, pardon me, just had our very first meeting or just issued our first action plan or got our first letter written to government, whatever it is, celebrate it. Third, and again, my friend Carol knew how to do that as well and as anyone, and was a ton of fun to do it with. Third, I firmly believe we are the most effective when we fight these causes with dignity. I think we are the most effective when we make sure our facts are accurate, when we make our arguments ones of principle, never ones of personal attack, when we present an image that is positive and that is dignified. And my friend Carol embodied that incredibly effectively, both privately and publicly, throughout her work together with us. You never lose by not taking a cheap shot. You never lose by taking the high ground. And you never lose by presenting yourself in a tone that is respectful and dignified, no matter how outrageous be the injustice that you're fighting against. And finally, my friend Carol would agree with me that if you want to be a successful advocate on social justice issues, you, like she and I, should simply practice the three laws of advocacy. Follow the three rules or the three commandments of advocacy that she and I and you can learn from the most effective advocate in the world. Not a bald, blind lawyer with a penchant for verbosity like me, but the truly effective advocate, a newborn baby. A newborn baby? A newborn baby. A newborn baby practices the three laws of advocacy, the three commandments of advocacy, more effectively than do I, and about as effectively as did my friend Carol. What are they? First, now picture the newborn baby as I say this. First, know exactly what you want to get. Second, make your message loud, clear, and simple. And third, do not stop till you get what you're after. Thank you very much for this opportunity to meet with you.